everybody, and welcome to episode 9 of season 2 of Why Do You Care? I'm your co-host, Will, and I'm here with Katie.
Hi there.
How you doing?
I've been really sick, so I apologize in advance that I'm a little bit throaty and a little bit... I was actually sick, though, not like, you know, when people have, like, a cold and they're like, oh, I've been so sick. And, like, I was, like, horror show sick, but I'm fine now. Thank you for asking.
I think the throatiness is why people listen.
Really? It's, like, on a whole other level today, so enjoy that, gang. Maybe it's past it, though. It's gone beyond Greta Garbo, and now it's just disgusting.
It doesn't sound that bad.
It's pretty bad. I'm now in recovery, so everything's fine.
You ready for this episode?
I'm super hyped, man. It's been ages since we've recorded, so I'm excited.
It's going to be a lot of me talking, I think.
Yeah, I like listening to you talk. I mean, it's how we survived our friendship, so.
What? Come on. It's 50-50 talking.
50-50. That sounds all right. and it's a fun episode, so I'm excited. It's going to be a cool topic.
Have you been watching anything interesting?
Well, I've been delirious for weeks, but I have been watching Agent Carter, which, like, a couple of people recommended me. And it's basically, it's a Marvel show about Peggy Carter. After Steve lands in the ice and the war's over, her founding SHIELD, basically. And I'm like a couple of episodes in, maybe 6 episodes in, and I really like it. It's like, it's a period piece, but it's really funny. It's got some really great actors in it.
I really like the woman who plays her.
Oh my God, Hayley, I can't remember, Atfield, Atwood, or whatever. Anyway, she's fucking amazing, and she's really good in this show. Like, she's super physical, which I love it. I love it when
Hayley
the girls
Atwell.
Like... Atwell, there you go, thank you. God bless the internet. She's wicked in this show. She's like super physical, and I love it when they do that, when they, you know, give the people like... Like, they did it with Daredevil. It was, like, the only good thing about Daredevil was how, like, they made his stunts really interesting and stuff, and they do the same with her. And she's basically... You find this out in the first episode, but she's trying to clear Howard Stark's name. Howard Stark is being accused of being a traitor. And so she's trying to clear his name, like, covertly. But, like, in the office, they're all treating her like, you know, the woman. They make her make tea. She's not allowed to make any decisions. She's not really being impactful in the way that she was during the war. And she's really frustrated with it. So on the, you know, the day-to-day, she's dealing with, like, sexism and bureaucracy. And then by night, she's like a super spy. It's wicked. Like, I'm really, really enjoying it. I didn't think I would. I thought it would be, like, you know, whatever. But I'm a completist, so I wanted to watch them all. But I super like it, and I'm hyped to finish season 1 and watch season 2.
Didn't it get, like, prematurely cancelled?
Yeah, they fucking cancelled it. They cancel everything. Rubbish. But, yeah.
I really like her episode of Black Mirror. I think that's the first thing I saw her in.
Shut up. What episode of Black Mirror was she in?
Be Right Back, the one with Domhnall Gleeson, where she...
Oh, my God. And they make him into a Twitter bot?
Yeah, they like use his social media presence to like create an AI of him.
I did not know that was her. Oh my God, I might rewatch that episode.
You should. Yeah, she's really good in it.
Yeah, she's a super fine actor. Like, I'm into her. I she's amazing in the movie. The First Avenger, and you know, she's great in this as well. So, props. But yeah, that's all I've really been watching because I've been catatonic. What about you? Have you been getting up to anything?
Well, I finally finished Orange is the New Black on your recommendation.
How'd you find it?
Well, I guess
it?
Not finished, but caught up.
Yeah.
I don't know. 3 was kind of mediocre, which is what I was expecting.
That's what I said. Yep.
The end of 4, though, is really good. Like, the back half of season 4 gets really good with all the new guards that come in and, like, the just... how the company that owns the prison is like running it into the ground, and things are getting worse and worse, and nobody's really paying attention to it, and it gets really good.
They do a lot of criticism about like the privatization of prisons and you know how that's just so damaging, and I thought it was really interesting the way they did that, a kind of reflective critique about the institution rather than just the people, rather like how it was actually run rather than individual guards or whatever. It was cool.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think state-run prisons are like a nice place to be, but there's definitely a perverse set.
I don't think any prison is good. Like abolish prisons, but anyway, that's another conversation. But no, I still thought it was interesting.
Yeah, they do a really good job of showing you the perverse incentives that happen when there's a company trying to make money off of keeping people there.
Yeah, totally. I really like it. I understand why people find it difficult and problematic. I think they deal with some really troubling themes and topics and stuff. So it's definitely not for everybody. But I think if you can watch it, you know, I find it really interesting. You know, and some of the themes and stuff are very complex and, you know, probably maybe shouldn't be presented lightly, but I don't feel that they do present anything in that show lightly. And I think they are always presenting it with a kind of an air of criticism, which I appreciate as a viewer. But yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I think part of my criticism of it is it's tonally like all over the place sometimes. Maybe this is more season three than season four, but it just feels like sometimes it's like a goofy sitcom with like relationship misunderstandings and drama, and then other times you're watching like horrible rape scenes. And there's something about I obviously don't mind mixing tones, because like I love Joss Whedon and I love Community and Dan Harmon, and that's you know perfect examples I think of kind of mixing a lot of different tones, but they for some reason it feels more cohesive in those shows, like in Buffy and Firefly, than it does in Orange is the New Black. Season four was better, but definitely during season three, I was kind of like, I can't get like into the tone of the show. It kept me from being more emotionally involved than I would have been, I think.
Yeah, I wasn't a massive fan of season three, but I thought it pulled its way back in season four. But we should do an episode on it. It was it's an interesting show to talk about. What else have you been watching?
I also started Westworld.
Oh God, so many people are talking about this. Is this good?
It's interesting. I mean, it's a new HBO show.
What's it about?
Well, I don't want to give too much away, because I think part of the fun of it is like discovering what's going on, but it's kind of about some sort of simulated world. It seems to not be in a computer, but like more like a Jurassic Park situation with AI, and that's Westworld, and rich people go there to indulge in their fantasies of being cowboys and sexual fantasies and acting out violent fantasies. And it's run by this company. So you're kind of watching this agency that's running the park, and you're watching the events in the park. But there's a lot of mystery. Like, you don't understand what else is going on in the world. You don't know what time period things are happening in. You're not sure who a lot of the characters are, and you know, there's the question of like who is an AI and who isn't, because there's like lifelike robots all over the synthetic people all over the park that are the hosts. And yeah, I don't know. There's a lot of good actors in it. Anthony Hopkins is in it. Ed Harris.
I love Ed Harris.
Yeah, and it's pretty good. So I've been enjoying the like mystery, figure out what's going on elements that have appeared in the first couple episodes.
I love anything about AI, so I think I'm almost definitely going to watch it. But I hate watching week by week, man. I like to watch it all in one go.
Yeah, that's part of the problem. One of the things I loved about the show was at the end of season two, Anthony Hopkins gives a speech, and it felt like kind of a commentary on media itself. Nice. And previous guest of the show and your friend Hugh tweeted that it seemed like it was criticizing Game of Thrones. Nice. So that endeared it to me.
Well, anything that's meta and also criticizes Game of Thrones gets a thumbs up from you, surely. It's ticking all your boxes.
There's like story creators that create, it's kind of like a MMO, like a massive multiplayer online game where there's all these NPCs running around, and there's all these, you know, hosts, non-players kind of going through their own storylines, and the players can get involved in them, kind of like quests.
Cool.
And
kind of like all these new theater where you go in and it's experiential and you have to follow around the players.
I don't know. I haven't done anything like that, but
okay.
It's kind of like The Matrix sounds mixed cool with Jurassic Park. But anyway, there's people who are the writers who create the like narratives that the guests in the park can get involved in. And this guy does this big presentation about this new narrative that he's created. And he's talking about how it involves like all of these horror elements and all of these sexual elements. And like, there's such, you know, you can like great moments of like violence and fighting and all these shocking moments and how like exciting and dramatic it's going to be. And then Anthony Hopkins, who's like the creator of the park, kind of says like, no. Like this is just, you know, spectacle for spectacle's sake. This isn't what people want. People care about the details and people care about finding the small things that they connect with. And it's a really nice speech that felt very meta, and it felt like a criticism of, you know, other shows.
Bombastic shows, yeah. Well, maybe, can I just wait until it's all out and then watch it all in one go, or?
You can do whatever you want.
Will I get spoiled, though? I'm probably going to get spoiled. Does it seem like the kind of show that you might get spoiled about?
I mean, it seems like the kind of show where being involved in the mystery and figuring out is part of it. And those shows, I think, Lost. Yeah. And those shows, I mean, if they're released all at once, that's fine. But I think if they're airing one at a time, you run the risk of not being part of that, like, cultural experience.
You basically just want to talk to me about it. That's fine. I'll watch it for you. It's okay. We're friends. I'll take that bullet.
Well, I mean, okay. You don't have to, but I would send you messages oh my God, can you believe what Ed Harris just did?
Mm-hmm. We need more reasons to talk to each other. That's true.
All right. So we have a topic today that's kind of like about storytelling theory and stuff.
Yeah.
But before we do it, I feel like there's another
movie
theory that we've been talking about, and I feel like we should cover that first.
Why do you just want to drag me? Like, I'm sick.
I want you to present your really good idea to the audience and see how it does in the marketplace of ideas.
I'm sick, and this is outrageous, okay? All right.
Tell the people what your movie idea is, your movie theory.
Okay, gang, look, okay. This is such an offhanded theory as well. But anyway, okay, so I have a theory that, like, works as a rule of thumb, that if you can tell what the movie is about from the title, it's probably a good movie. And if you can't tell what the movie is about from the title, it's probably hipster nonsense. And this theory works for so many movies. But obviously Will, ever since he heard about this theory, has just been basically being like, oh, what about this example? What about this example? And it's like, of course, there are going to be hundreds of examples that disprove it. Like, whatever. But
I don't even think that's my problem. I think the examples you gave me didn't even support the theory. Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol does not describe the events of that movie.
The events of that movie is that they go on a mission that is impossible, and Protocol, Ghost Protocol, whatever, it tells you that something else happens because it's fourth in the series. Captain America Civil War is another example. Captain America is involved. He's the main character, and there is a civil war that's happening. The Godfather. All right,
Captain America Civil War,
maybe. It's about a Godfather.
Maybe.
Like, come on, Mean Girls. It's about a bunch of mean girls. Ferris Bueller's Day Off. It's about Ferris Bueller, and he has a day off.
My argument is not that there's some
Goodfellas.
Movies.
It's about a bunch of Goodfellas. Taxi Driver. It's about a taxi driver. I'm just saying that, like, if you can tell what it is. Okay, so this theory came about because my partner Vim really wanted me to watch Upstream Color, right? And I was like putting it off for ages. And then eventually I was like, oh, this film's going to be rubbish. What even does Upstream Color mean? Like, this is fucking stupid. I don't even have, like, watched this. I've got no interest in this. And then he watched it and it was bad. And I was like, see, if you'd known what it was about, you wouldn't have watched it.
I think what we call this is selection bias, where you're cherry picking examples and making a pattern out of them, and the pattern doesn't exist.
Okay. But like, the pattern does exist. Like, everyone's favorite movies nearly works for this. Like, seriously, Get Drunk in the Pub, more times than not, this is true. This is a good rule of thumb to judge movies by. Okay, I will admit that the Coens basically disprove this theory. However, the best Coens movie, which is A Serious Man, fits the rule. It's a movie about a serious man.
Oh my God. All right, but first of all, even the definitions, there's problems. Like, the movie, you could say every movie title is about the thing in the title. That doesn't mean it describes the movie.
Oh my, like, God, you're such a Moya right now. What are you talking about?
Okay, like 300, it's about 300 Spartans. But 300 doesn't describe the events of the movie.
That's not a good movie.
All right, but even Ghost Protocol, it's about the Ghost Protocol. It doesn't tell you, okay, what is that Ghost Protocol? What does that mean? What happens in the movie?
It's the title, Will. You can't have loads of detail in a title. Otherwise, that would be the synopsis of the film.
No, there are movie titles that describe, like Ferris Bueller's Day Off, I think describes the events of the movie to some degree. The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford describe the events of the movie, at least something that's going to happen.
Yeah, but like Independence Day, it's talking about Independence Day. Jurassic Park, it's talking about a Jurassic Park. Come on! Like, all of these films work for this theory.
You're just describing, like, titles.
Extraterrestrial. It's about an extraterrestrial.
But that's like every movie title. You can always say it's about the name of the title.
No, but you can't. That's my point. There are so many fucking films where the title, like Upstream Color, it means nothing. What is that film even about? No one cares.
I don't know what Upstream Color is
exactly,
about.
Exactly, because you can't tell from the title. Have a guess, because whatever you guess that, it's not true.
But if I hadn't seen, like, Gravity, I wouldn't know what Gravity was about.
That's not a good film.
I think that's a perfectly good film.
No. Oh, it's a metaphor for birth. Rubbish. Hated it.
It's 96% on Metacritic and Rotten Tomatoes. I think this is a quality movie.
No, it's rubbish.
All right, what about Interstellar? Is that a good movie?
Oh my God, I love that movie. There's always an exception to the rule.
Oh my God. What I'm saying is there's so many exceptions, there's not a rule.
This is the rule. I'm saying it's a rule of thumb, though. I'm not saying that it's right in every situation, but I'm just saying in most situations, if you can tell what the film is about, Die Hard, it's probably a good movie.
Die Hard is not what the movie is about.
It is. He's like not being able to die. It's really hard.
Oh my God.
I'm just saying, from the title Die Hard, you know it's an action film. You know that he's going to, like, push back and be victorious. You can just tell what the film is about.
No, you only know what it's about because you've seen the movie. If you had never seen Die Hard, you'd be like, I have no idea what that's about.
No, I disagree. I think it's obvious.
Somebody who doesn't die very easily?
Yeah, that is what Bruce Willis is. And that tells you that is an action film as well.
Oh, my God. Okay. I think our listeners should weigh in.
On my flawless theory.
Yeah. I mean.
It's flawless. Everyone agrees with me. You're just bitter because everyone agrees with me.
I'm not bitter at all. I'm just shocked.
Oh my God, you're so bitter.
That so many people think that this is a viable way to judge movies.
I'm not saying that it's 100. I concede it's not right in every. Like, one of my favorite movies doesn't fit this rule because one of my favorite movies is There Will Be Blood, and you can't tell what that's going to be about. You don't know that's about oil from that title. So there's always going to be movies that, you know, don't fit the rule. But as a rule of thumb, this is an excellent rule of thumb.
I mean, okay.
And more often than not, it's true.
Is Terminator 2 Judgment Day? Is that descriptive of the events of the movie to you?
It's the second Terminator movie. Yes.
So any sequel fits this if it has two in it because it tells you it's the second title, of the movie.
If the title tells you what it's about, Alien is about one alien. Aliens is about more than one alien. It works. You know I'm right.
Oh my
and
God.
Alien versus Predator is not good because actually that fight doesn't happen. So there you go.
Is Leprechaun 2 good because it tells you it's
film,
the second
so I
Leprechaun?
Tell
movie?
You. I oh couldn't my God. Tell you.
The answer is no.
Look, I'm just saying that, you know, it's a good rule of thumb and people should consider it.
Is Leprechaun in the Hood good?
I've not seen it. I have no idea.
It tells you.
Are you just assuming because I've got Irish heritage that I've seen all the Leprechaun movies? What's happening? What's happening here? What's happening here?
That's peak Irish art.
There you go. There you go.
Okay.
That's my theory that Will hates with every fiber of his being and felt the need to drag me for on our podcast that we do together as friends.
It's not hate. You act like I have like personal feelings toward the theory and I don't.
I feel like you do.
Well, I feel frustration because everybody and all of our friends, you're like saying this theory and they're like, oh yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I'm like, monkey face palm emoji. No, it doesn't make any sense.
It's so great. It's the greatest theory of all time.
All right, so we talk about a different theory about stories.
Oh, because like it's well thought out and smart because you've come up with it.
Yeah, well, this is to contrast your...
Sexist.
Oh my God. We're going to use every... You've already used the Irish card. Are you using
Irish
the woman card?
Woman card, friendship support card. They're all coming out.
I know, yeah.
No, let's hear your theory, because this is a great theory and I like
it very
much.
Mark of desperation.
Mark of desperation. Okay. Let's hear your theory, because I like it.
Well, it's not my theory.
Well, the theory that you explained to me.
Okay, so the idea is we're gonna talk about story structure. And story structure is basically like the shape of a plot, like what happens in a plot, the order that things happen. You know, it's, you know, when people talk about like stories should have beginning, middles, and ends, they're talking about story structure. We have this idea about stories that stories resonate with us because they reflect things that we've experienced, like specific experiences, like, you know, love or being broken up with or unrequited love or fear or loss or grief or friend, you know, all of the things that characters go through in movies that we connect to because they're a reflection of experiences that we've had. And I think the idea with story structure is, in the same way that specific stories reflect specific experiences, story structure is supposed to reflect something about the nature of experience itself.
Okay.
Versus the idea that a structure of a story could be random, right? Like random events after events after event, right? Like this happens and then this happens and then this happens and they're unrelated and they don't have any impact on each other. Like we kind of instinctively get that that's not a story. And I think when stories do resonate with us, like on a fundamental level, it's because the way that they're unfolding is a reflection of something about our experience, the nature of our experience itself. So, you know, and I think that's the main thesis here. So if you're going to take away like one core idea, it's that the form of certain stories resonate with human beings more than other structures. And the reason that those certain structures resonate more is because they more accurately reflect the nature of experience and how human beings experience the world and, you know, our society or nature itself, that there's something deep and fundamental that is being reflected in the structure of the story. I know that's kind of like an abstract and weird idea, but I think it's really powerful and important when you're trying to understand like why some stories work and other ones don't.
Okay.
So yeah, that's the idea. If specific stories are reflections of our lives, then like, you know, story structure is a reflection of life itself. Very profound. But
if a reflection of life itself or a reflection of how we go through life? Just for clarity.
Both, I think. Okay, of how we go through life.
Sure, sure.
But I think we also see, I think in certain story structures and like the specific one that I'm going to talk about in this episode, I think there are also, it also mirrors things that happen in the natural world.
Okay.
Like, you know, a life and death kind of cycle and stuff like that.
Okay.
So there's a lot of different ideas about story structure. You might have heard of like the seven basic plots.
Yeah.
And Joseph Campbell's Hero with a Thousand Faces is like the, you know, the granddaddy of all of them that describes the hero's journey.
Yeah, I think you've talked about that before on the podcast.
Mm-hmm. The one I'm going to talk about here is kind of a watered down synthesis of that.
Cool.
That was created by Dan Harmon. And so a lot of the stuff
Dan
that
Harmon
I'm...
Dan Harmon of Community fame?
Yep. He used to have a website called Channel 101, and they would do like short films and skits on it. And on that site, he wrote a series of articles describing his ideas about story structure. And he takes them from a couple different people like Christopher Vogler and Joseph Campbell. And he kind of synthesizes it down into what I think is a not overly simplified, but not complicated and convoluted structure. And it's the one that, you know, I've read a lot of other ones and there's always something about them that I think is true or that resonates. But I think his is kind of like the best because it is in that perfect area of the Venn diagram where it's simple, but it also explains enough with enough specifics. And it's easy to understand. So that's the one I'm going to talk about. But there's a lot of them. And I think even the other ones, if you're interested in going and reading about other people's ideas, even those ones fit, I think, my main thesis that certain structures resonate more with us. And the reason they do is because they're reflective of our experience, the nature of our experiences.
Cool.
Like Matt Stone and Trey Parker, there's a video, they're the creators of South Park. And they were giving a talk, I think in front of other writers, about how they break stories. And they're talking about the different scenes from an episode of South Park that, you know, they'll put them on a board and they'll look at what is connecting the scenes. And if there's just a and then, like, you know, Cartman does this, and then Kyle does this, and then Stan does this, then they think that that's a problem and it's not going to be compelling for people because it's just, you know, event, 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 event.
Sure.
And they try to go in, and between those different scenes, they try to put a therefore or a because. So Cartman does this, therefore Kyle does this, but Stan does this, therefore Kenny does this.
Okay.
And, you know, that idea is basically just adding causality between the different scenes and events.
And motivation and stuff like that.
Right, exactly. There's actions and reactions. And again, I think that fits the thesis that we don't experience our lives, or we don't experience events as being, you know, random things that happen one after another. We experience them as being causal, and yeah, one thing causing another thing to happen. And then there's something else that causes a different reaction, and that causes something else to happen. So, you know, even a simple idea like your scene should have because and therefore between them, I think kind of speaks to the general idea that it should reflect the nature of our experiences, because that's how we experience our lives.
Well, because of the role of individual agency, right?
Yeah. And I think even, you know, even if you look at nature, nature is not a bunch of disconnected things happening. There's causality in it, and things sure result in other things, and there's consequences and reactions. And
this is cool. Tell me more about this. I'm interested.
There's even another simple one by a writer, Jim Thompson, who said there's only one plot and it's things are not as they seem.
Nice. Oh, I love a one-line thesis, man. It's so cool. I'm just like, darn, it's so deep. And go,
I know. Well, I think that's a little too simplified to like give people something to really go on.
Well, you
which
know,
is why
I love a simple theory. You know?
I know. But even that one, I think, kind of fits the idea that like that is some, that's a reflection of our experience, not maybe specific experiences, but the kind of the nature of our experiences also is sure that like things are not as they seem.
Sure. I guess it means how you interpret it as well, you know, like, yeah. But
well,
anyway,
that's one of the reasons, that's one of the problems with, I think, oversimplified ideas like this is you can very easily map them onto anything almost.
I feel like there's a underlying passive aggression there, but okay,
no,
that's
no,
fine.
No, no, there isn't.
I'm messing. Gone. Anyway, tell me more about this.
There's certainly stories or movies where everything is exactly how it seems, and I think we all know going in that that's boring.
Exactly. It's not what people watch the movies for.
Right. So anyway, the point is there's a lot of different ideas about story structure, but I think the good ones fit my general thesis.
Cool.
But I'm going to talk more about Dan Harmon's story circles in particular, and I'll put a bunch of links in the show notes to like his articles where he described it. And yeah, like I said, I think that his is not too simple and arbitrary, and it's also not overly complicated and hyper specific like Joseph Campbell's can get to that point where there's a lot of very specific events in there, and I don't know if that's necessary for something to be a story.
Okay.
And that's the kind of like the question I think that makes a lot of these theories come out is like, what makes something a story? Like what makes it a story to human beings versus just a bunch of stuff happening? Okay, you ready to get into the specific?
I'm ready, bro. Let's go. Deep dive.
So the first thing is that the story is a circle.
Okay.
That's the shape of the plot. And that there is, it's a descent and a return.
Okay.
So it's not just kind of like a straight linear plot, you know, man goes to the store, that's it. It's, you know, man goes to the store and he comes back from the store.
Sure.
A hunter leaves the village and he comes back to the village after going on a hunting journey. And even that is like, that might be the nature of how we first started hearing about stories was because people left the tribe and they came back and had things happen to them and they sure described them to us.
Okay.
And if nobody ever comes back, then you don't get any stories.
Oh my God. Right. Okay.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of this stuff.
I'm really sad for the hunter now, but carry on.
He found a better tribe.
Oh, fuck. What a bastard.
But there's no story.
No story.
So picture a circle and, you know, you're moving from the top of the circle to the bottom and then you're moving back up to the top and it's like a descent and a return.
Okay.
So now you're going to have to visualize some things in your mind.
Jesus.
It's God, not too hard.
It's like actual work, man. What's that about? It's too high end.
So now, cut your circle in half horizontally, right? Okay. So there's a top half of a circle and a bottom half of the circle.
Yeah.
So the bottom half of the circle represents a new situation.
Okay.
Like a new experience or a new world or something that is different from the top half of the circle, which is like the known world.
Okay.
And the idea is that the protagonist enters the bottom half and it's something that contrasts their normal world.
Sure.
So if the top half is something like, you know, normal life and stability and regularness and order, then the bottom half is, you know, instability and craziness and uncontrollability and
disorder,
scary and disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think that reflects, you know, the nature of our experiences where we're in places of known quantities and then we enter new situations and they're very different from what we're used to. And we have a bunch of experiences in them. And then we come back to the regular world after that, or that experience ends and we have gone through something. It's like, that's like the very idea of you go through something and then you come out the other end of it and it has affected you in some way.
Okay. So the second half, the bottom half of the circle is like the bulk of the action.
Yeah, that's like the story, basically. Okay. That's like this chunk of the story that...
Sure.
You know, Dan Harmon, when he's giving like some more theory about what the importance of that bottom half, he says that it's important that it doesn't just represent a new situation, that it has to contrast the old situation. And that one of the ways of thinking about the contrast is that the top half is consciousness. And the bottom half is unconsciousness, or your unconscious. The top half is order, and the bottom half is disorder or chaos. The top half is life, and the bottom half is death.
Okay.
And again, this also, you know, is in line with the thesis that, like, that's the cycle of an ecosystem, that you have life, and you have death, and then you have a new life as a result of that. And that it fits the nature of societies, where societies have periods of order, and then if they're going to change and grow, they go through periods of disorder, and then they return back to a period of order, having changed as a result of the disruptive, you know, maybe revolutionary, but changes in society, that's what happens, that you have to go through a period of disorder, and that keeps the health of the ecosystem or of the society intact. And he says the same thing is true with individuals and the conscious mind and the unconscious mind, that you have to go through periods of exploring the unconscious and come back to the, you know, come back to your conscious world having changed as a result of that. He has a really good quote about it that I have in here that I'm going to read. He likens the unconscious part of your mind to a basement. So he goes, the unconscious is exactly what it sounds like. It's the stuff you don't, won't, or can't think about. According to Freud, there are dirty pictures of your mother down there. According to Jung, there are pipes, wires, and even tunnels down there that connect your home to others. And even though it contains life-sustaining energies, like the fuse box or the water heater, it's a primitive, stinky, scary place, and it's no wonder that given the choice, we don't want to hang out down there. However, your pleasure, your sanity, and even your life depend on the occasional round trip. You've got to change the fuses, grab the Christmas ornaments, clean the litter box. To the extent that we keep the basement door sealed, the entire home becomes unstable. The creatures downstairs get louder, and the guy upstairs, your ego, tries to cover the noise with neurotic behavior. For some, eventually, the basement door can come right off its hinges, and the slimy primal denizens of the deep can become Scrabble partners. You might call this a nervous breakdown or psychotic break. It doesn't matter. The point is, occasional ventures by the ego into the unconscious through therapy, meditation, confession, sex, violence, or even a good story keeps the consciousness in working order.
That's pretty wild. Okay, let me just think about this for a second. So he's basically saying that in order to be productive and healthy, like, that's why it's part of the cycle, that you have to go through the bottom half of the circle.
Yeah. And, you know, like a society or like an ecosystem and like in an individual, you have to go through these periods of unrest where you are discovering uncomfortable things or facing things about yourself in order to maintain the overall health of the system.
Okay. So you have to be challenged.
Right. That you want to, everybody just wants to stay in the nice part, right? The life part.
Of course,
the order
comfy
part.
Up there. Got a sofa, Netflix.
Right. But that's not what That's not the nature of our experience. That's not what has to happen. If in a society or in an ecosystem, you have to go through these periods of change. You have to go through death. You have to go through unrest. You have to explore the things that are in your unconscious one way or another in order to keep things truly stable.
Because we're evolving constantly.
Right.
And we're
changing.
The idea
is if you stayed up top, you'd never change.
Sure.
And that's not how life works. Like, you have to go through periods of change. You have to face those things.
Moving ever forward.
Yeah, exactly. And so we'll get to more specifics of like what happens down there.
Cool.
So that's the bottom half of the circle. So you can also divide the circle in vertically in half. So you have a right side and a left side.
Okay.
And those ones should also have contrast. And in with these two halves, you can build in a lot of themes, like maybe you have control on the right half and lack of control on the left half, or dishonesty on the right half and honesty on the left half. And I'll explain how that works in a second. But I think the most important one that every story needs to have is volition. What is happening as a result of the character's volition. And on the right
half...
That's
such a fancy word. Sorry. I like it.
Or their own choice.
I like it. It's fancy. No, keep us high end, man. I'm into it. Go on.
So the right half is events that are not happening as a result of the character's choices, that they're kind of being dragged along. They're falling down the rabbit hole like Alice. And that the second half is the character taking things in their own hands and being an agent of change and acting on their own volition.
Cool.
So this is if we're going around clockwise.
Yeah, okay.
But like I said, you can also put, you know, themes that your story is about on the right half and on the left half. So if your theme is, you know, if you're writing a story about honesty, you might have dishonesty on the right half and honesty on the left half. And how the character would go around that is they're in the known world. They're in their comforting regular world and they're not being honest about something. You know, they're in a state of dishonesty, and then they enter a new situation and they continue to be in a state of dishonesty about it. And then in order to deal with that new world that they're in, they take matters into their own hands and they become honest, and then they come back to the regular world, you know, the place of comfort and where they were before. And now they are honest in that situation.
Okay.
So you could do the same thing with like control versus lack of control. You know, you're in the regular world and you are in control. You like being in control of something. You enter a new situation that's very different and you try to maintain control over it. And at some point you realize you can't. And so you let go of control. And then when you come back to the known world, you have given up on trying to be in control, or you have a more healthy relationship with control itself.
Okay.
So the halves are important for themes.
Sure. So, but you cut the bottom half, you go vertical and horizontal, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you end up with quarters. And so that
you end up
each
with quarters,
quarter is more dramatic and whatever. Yeah. Okay, cool. Okay. I'm with you.
Right. So now we're going to divide it up even more specifically.
I feel like I'm in class, but it's like a fun class. You're like a cool professor. It's cool.
I know. I'm sorry. It's just so much
no,
explaining.
No, I like it. No,
like,
I like it. Okay. You always think I'm taking the piss, man. I like it. Come on. It's good. And I also like the fancy words. It's good.
So now we have the circles bisected twice. Once vertically, once horizontally. And now we're going to... There's two more lines. A point within each of those quarters.
Sure.
So if we're going to number them, one is at the top.
Mm-hmm.
Two is in the middle of the top and... The start of the bottom half.
Sure.
So 1, 2, 3 is the start of the bottom half. 4 is in the middle of that. And the start of the second vertical half. 5, 6, 7, 8 is between the... 8 is when you're back in the known world.
Sure.
On the top left side of the circle. Is this easy to visualize?
I can see it. And I'm like a really, you know... I'm like a stupid person, so that's good. Let's go.
Well, we can put a picture of it in the show notes so people can look
at
it.
No, I can see it. I think that was a really good description. Let's go.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's a circle with 8 points around it.
Yeah.
And 1 parallels 5, and 2 parallels 6, and 3 parallels 7, and 4 parallels 8.
Cool.
Those are bisectors, basically, dividing up the circle.
Cool.
So each of those points is kind of a beat in the story.
Okay.
And even though it's a circle and they're all kind of, you know, they're all kind of equally spaced out, not all these things necessarily are given equal spacing in like the timeline of a story. but they're the beats that a character is going to go through.
Okay.
So number one at the very top is when you establish a protagonist.
Yep.
And they're in a zone of comfort. They're in the known world. You know, their life is relatively stable. It's ordered. It's safe to whatever degree. Boom, you've established, and that's the top of the circle.
Luke on Tatooine.
Yeah, exactly. So number two is you establish that something is wrong with this world, that the character has something that they need or they have some desire that's not fulfilled, that, you know, maybe the world is not as safe and as nice as it seems. And mm-hmm. even though there's relative comfort, like things could be better.
Okay.
That's usually expressed as like the character wanting something or needing something. So number three is they enter the new world. That's the bottom half of the circle. They, you know, this Joseph Campbell calls this crossing the threshold.
Okay.
It's when the character is pulled or whatever because of circumstances, they find themselves in a new situation.
So him meeting Ben.
Him meeting Ben. Yep. And his aunt and uncle are killed, and then he decides, okay, fine, I guess I'll go along on this adventure.
Cool. Okay.
It's the call to adventure.
The call to adventure. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So number four is they adapt to the new circumstances. And this is the point in the story where the protagonist learns about the world, the new rules of the world. He meets friends, he meets enemies, he makes allies, he may learn some skills. If we're still going with Star Wars, you know, this you're in this point where they get to the Mos Eisley Cantina and they're meeting Chewie and Han. There's stormtroopers after them. He's on the Millennium Falcon and he's learning how to use the Force and how to use his lightsaber. A lot of times this fourth stage is also a training sequence, and sometimes it's literally the training montage in the movie.
Training montage. Amazing. Yeah. I love it. Love a good training montage.
So five, this is the one that is parallel to one. This is the bottom of the circle and the start of the second vertical half.
Okay.
This is the low point. This is when the character gets what they needed. It might not be what they wanted, but it is, they get something. They
you
learn
lose
some
the fight
lesson.
At the karate championship.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This is called, Joseph Campbell calls this meeting with the goddess. And a lot of times there is literally a woman that is met by the male protagonist. It doesn't have to be that, but that's just kind of like a typical trope of stories. But the point is that the character, there's a low point. It's a point of rest, right? It's opposite one, and there's parallels between them, where one was a point of rest, and then you're going to get dragged all the way down to five, and you're at another point of rest where you're learning something. And a lot of times this is the low point for the character, where they've been broken or they think all hope is lost or whatever. And to move past this point, they've got to take matters into their own hands. It's the beginning of the volition, you know, acting of their own accord for the second half. And this is also usually accompanied with images of weightlessness or dream sequences, floating. There's a lot of stuff like that happens here that you can kind of, you know, keep your eye out for, like, that stuff to let you know that you're at this low point. There's usually a tension break, right? Okay. After the first half, all this stuff is happening and it's high tension and the character's going through all this stuff and learning all this stuff. And then there's like a point of rest. And to move past this point, now they got to act on their own. What comes next is six. And that is the price. So a price must be paid for the character getting what they need or being involved in this situation. And that's when the protagonist loses something that is valuable or important to them.
Okay.
And a lot of times it's the thing that has been motivating you or keeping you going through the first half. And you have to lose that again, because part of the second half is that the character's acting on their own.
Independently.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So they have to lose that thing that has been guiding them. If we're talking about Star Wars, this is when Ben dies. This is when Obi-Wan dies.
Yeah. When Dumbledore dies.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. And so this parallels two, where two is, you know, you're in a place of comfort, but something's wrong. This is you were in a place of comfort, getting what you need, some kind of low point, and now something is wrong. You've paid a price for that.
Okay.
Seven is the boundary again between the top half of the circle and the bottom half of the circle. And that is when you return to a familiar situation. It doesn't have to mean literally the same physical mm-hmm. location, but a lot of times it is. But this is, there's usually an escape. Joseph Campbell calls this a magic flight or escape from without, or rescue from without. So the characters are, they get out of whatever, you know, adventurous, new, dangerous situation they're in, and they make it back to some point of relative safety, or, you know, some point of order and known quantity again.
Yep.
And eight is you show that how the character, as a result of this stuff that they've been through, has changed.
Cool.
I think Joseph Campbell calls this Master of Both Worlds.
Nice.
And so you...
That's dramatic. I like it.
Yeah, well, you show that the character has entered the new world, they have conquered it, they have come out the other end, and now they are a, Dan Harmon calls this, you're a world-altering ninja.
Nice.
They've been to the strange place, they adapted to it, they discovered true power, and now they're back when they started, forever changed and forever capable of creating change. That's a very powerful moment in the movies. A lot of times that's when they're defeating the villain. You also, a lot of times it's common for something from the new world to have followed them back into like the place of safety.
Okay.
And now the hero has to face it. And okay. You show how the hero has overcome stuff. And this one parallels four, which is the friends, allies, and enemies and the training sequence.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times you show that the main character wins, the protagonist wins by using things that he learned about the world in the fourth phase.
Cool.
So Luke learns about the Force, you know, in number four when he's on the Millennium Falcon, and he uses the Force to defeat the Death Star.
Sure.
So that is it. That is the cycle. That's the story circle.
Like, it's really interesting because even as you're going through it, I'm like, man, this like works for a lot of movies. It's cool.
It works
There's
for
lots
so
of
many
really
movies.
Good examples that you can like use for it. It's cool.
Yeah, I have a bunch of examples.
Let's do it.
We should go through some of them.
I love examples. Let's do it. It roots it, man.
But does everything about what I explained kind of make sense? Or
yeah, there... it totally makes sense. I think, so I'm just interested in this. So the suggestion isn't necessarily that films or whatever need eight phases. It's just that there are eight points and beats that have to be hit in order for the film to be like structurally satisfying for an audience member.
Yeah, I think like a lot of theories, this is both prescriptive and descriptive, where
sure.
It's attempting to describe the stories that seem to be particularly resonant with human beings, like universally resonating with human beings.
Sure.
And then to turn that into like a guidepost. So it's not like you have to do all of these things. But in the way that it's descriptive, it's really hard to avoid doing them a lot of times.
Sure.
Like imagine telling a story where a character doesn't enter a new situation and it doesn't change them or challenge them in any way, or they don't learn anything as a result of it. It kind of, the less you follow it, I think the automatically less compelling your story becomes. And it doesn't mean that you have to hit, you know, everything in a very tropey way and just copy something like Star Wars. That's very by the numbers. But I think to some degree, these things have to be happening where you got to have a protagonist for the audience to connect with. They have to have some problems or some desire. They have to be in a new situation that challenges them. They have to learn something as a result of it. Maybe they don't necessarily have to pay a price for it, but I think that resonates with us. I think that's part of the nature of our experience that like, as we go through things that challenge us, you know, we lose things and we have to deal with the loss of that. And we have to keep going of our own volition in order to make it through those experiences and come out of the other side being whatever.
So, I mean, the thing is the structure allows us to anchor our own experience in what we're viewing, right? And it means that we can resonate with it and it can relate to our own experience of the world.
Yeah, I think the idea is it makes it look like an experience to us.
Yeah.
This very like whatever specific things the characters are going through, they may line up with specific experiences we've had, but the whole nature of what they're experiencing should look to us like things that we experience.
Yeah.
The nature of the things that we experience.
So like the transition is familiar to us. The transition from point one to point eight is something that we will have experienced even on a kind of a micro scale.
Right.
We're saving the universe from Darth Vader, but like because, you know, our own drama in our life.
Right. We go through things in our life and they change us. And, you know, we have to learn to react to them of our own accord and overcome them and as a result of that, we're changed. And I think if you don't do that, you have kind of a stagnant life to some degree. Sure. And the same way that a story where that doesn't happen comes off as a very boring story.
Kind of dry, yeah.
Nothing changes. The characters don't enter new situations. They don't ever overcome anything. They don't learn anything.
Because, like, the only time that I've ever really talked about structure, because I didn't, is in drama. So in drama, it's like a 4 or 5 beat, depending on how you do it, which is you start with exposition, you have rising drama, you have the climax, you have falling drama, and you have the denouement. Mm-hmm. And it's like, but that's really different because that's linear and that's about one course of action. Whereas what this is about how you go from the beginning to the end of the story and you experience it as an individual rather than the kind of wider plot.
I think those rising drama and climax and stuff, I think those map to the circle. Yeah. As like what's happening emotionally.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So like,
and maybe they push the plot, but they don't necessarily push the story. Like there's kind of nuance there, right?
Yeah. I'm not sure. What do you mean by they push the plot, but not the story?
Well, like the plot of what's happening in Star Wars is, you know, that there's an evil empire and there's an uprising against the empire, and then the empire is defeated and then order is restored to the galaxy. That's the plot.
Right.
But the story is Luke going through that plot.
Right.
Do you see what I mean? Like, I might be muddling the terms, but for me, I feel like there is a difference between the overarching plot of a movie and the individual story for a
kind
character.
Of like plot as setting.
Yeah, right.
Is how you're talking about it. Yeah. I mean,
does that not fit in with your...
I think it fits in for me. But I think those emotional arcs you're talking about in drama have to follow the protagonist, the way he's going through those events.
Well, because we see it through their perspective anyway, whoever the
protagonist
is.
Right, and we're emotionally connected to them, so...
Well, we should be, otherwise it's shit, right?
Right, otherwise, yeah.
Bad movie.
All right, so let's talk some examples. We were kind of using Star Wars as an example, as
it's
I was describing it.
It's a go-to example, man, you know what I mean?
It is. Yeah. We should run through it really quick, because I think it's very... illustrative of the
illustrative. That's how you pronounce it. What's fun about Star Wars is I feel like each movie would work for it, as well as the whole trilogy.
Yeah, the whole trilogy does work. I think each movie does work.
Yeah, maybe.
But I haven't actually mapped out the other ones.
Let's do the whole trilogy. That's fine. Oh, is that what you've done? A New Hope. Okay, let's do a New Hope. Yeah.
Especially because this was. Like George Lucas made this, I think, with Joseph Campbell's hero's journey in mind.
He should have kept it in mind.
Yeah, I mean,
I can't.
Well, so he was trying to make a very like universal, well-known format to the story. So I think that's one of the reasons why it's particularly good. The Matrix is also really good. But okay, so at point one, the top of the circle, Luke is in a boring zone of comfort, being a boring farmer on a boring sand planet with no friends and no girls and no adventure. And, you know, it's relatively stable, but like that's where he is.
Hashtag sad Luke.
Yeah. Well, sad Luke is number two.
Okay.
So then the second point on the circle is there's something wrong with that. He has desires that are greater than what his known quantity, place of comfort allows for. He wants to do something more with his life. He doesn't want to just be a farmer. He wants to be a hero, or he wants to have an adventure. He wants to get the girl. And that's when I always talk about this scene because I love it, where he's staring at the binary sunset and looking longingly off at what could be of his life if he didn't have to stay at the farm for another season. And John Williams is swelling with the orchestral music. That's point two. That's the need. That's when you're like connecting with Luke. Like, I get what you're going through, buddy. You want to be out of this place. You want to have something more to your life.
Yep.
Step three in the circle, entering the new world of adventure and instability. That's when he gets the droids and he meets Obi-Wan, and his aunt and uncle are killed. And, Obi-Wan's basically explicitly giving him a call to action, saying, come away with me, learn the ways of the Force, be a Jedi. Fight the Empire.
It's world expanding though, right? That's
Right. For the audience and for the protagonist. Like, yeah. We don't know what the greater world is really like at this point.
Yeah.
And Luke does. I mean, Luke knows that there's aliens and all that stuff out there, but we don't really even know it. And so we're also kind of going through this, which is why when we get to 4, the next point, that's where you start adapting to the new world. That's when he goes to Mos Eisley and you're meeting all these aliens and he's having confrontations and he meets Han and Chewie and they get on the Millennium Falcon and they're running away from stormtroopers. And he starts learning about the Force and he uses his lightsaber and he puts the blast shield down on his helmet and Obi-Wan is telling him, like, you know, trust your instincts, reach out with your mind, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. 5 is when Luke gets what he needs, which is he is on the Death Star and he goes and he finds Leia. Yeah. He says, I'm Luke Skywalker. I'm here to rescue. Like, look, he's having adventures. He's meeting a girl. He's, you know, in a shootout. Him and Han are working together and he's like being a hero. He's not having a boring farmer life. So that's, you know, then there's a literal meeting with the goddess there. And he's also beginning to do those things of his own accord, right? So he's not just being dragged along by Obi-Wan. In fact, Obi-Wan goes off and he's doing his own thing. And Luke is the one being like, no, we know where the princess is. We know what cell number she's in. Let's go and get her. 6 is where you pay the price.
Too sad. Don't talk about it.
So, you know, he gets what he wanted, what he needs, and he has to pay a price for that. And that price is losing Obi-Wan. And I said before that a lot of times that parallels 2, which is, you know, you're everything is good. Everything is at, like, in a good place. And then something is wrong with it, which parallels how 2 is. And it's also a lot of times the thing that appears in 2 that is kind of motivating the story or giving the character hope or giving the character guidance, which, you know, Obi-Wan, that's what Obi-Wan's role is up until that point, and he has to lose that in order to continue on his own. The return or the escape, that's when they you know, break out of the Death Star and they fly away and they're being chased and they have to fight off the TIE fighters that are chasing them, and then they kind of return to a place of relative safety, which is the Rebel base. But this is 8. Something has followed them from, you know, the new world, and that's the Death Star. The Death Star was tracking them. It let them get away, and now it comes to Yavin 4 to blow up the planet. You know, something evil has followed him back after his adventure.
Yeah.
And he has to use the things that he learned in 4, which is across the circle from 8, to overcome it. And, you know, he puts away his targeting computer and he uses the Force, and his ally that he met in 4 comes back and helps him win, Han.
Yeah.
And you show how he's grown as a result of the whole thing.
Cool.
And then, you know, you have a nice little closing ceremony and the movie ends.
Nice. That's so neat.
It's very neat.
Yeah,
it fits really well. But let's do, I have a TV one. I have Breaking Bad.
Oh my God.
Somebody actually put together these images, and I will link them in the show notes. But Walter White's journey throughout the entire show fits this. And a lot of times, if it's a TV show, you spend a lot of time in 4, which is the adapting to the world.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of times, the pilot will introduce the character to the new world. And then you live most of the time in 4 for the run of the show, and then near the end of the show, maybe the last season, you start going through the later cycles, or the later half of the circle. So in Breaking Bad, you know, he's kind of a schmucky pushover of a guy.
Chem teacher.
Yeah, I mean, he has a okay life.
That guy
life.
Is horrible to him, right? In the car wash. Like, gives him a load of shit.
People walk all over him. He's kind of doesn't get a lot of respect. His life is kind of boring. He doesn't have a lot of power in his life, but it's relatively stable, right? He has a job and he has a family. It's on his birthday and he's getting
house.
He's getting
kids,
his eggs,
whatever.
With a little 50.
Oh my God, I forgot about that. The bacon.
Laid out in bacon.
No, I want bacon.
Right. So he's in a zone of comfort. But you know, something's wrong. He finds out he has cancer.
He has super bad cough. Yeah.
In addition to, you know, there's obviously things he's displeased with about his life, and you know, not feeling very powerful or in control of it and being bullied by people like Hank and other people.
Yeah, Hank was really douchey in the early seasons.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's also Hank that shows him the meth lab bust and how much money there is.
Yeah, he takes him on a ride along, doesn't he?
He takes him on a ride along too. This is important.
Yeah.
So then he enters a new world of, you know, making meth and being a drug dealer, kingpin, producer.
Yep.
And he has all kinds of challenges that he has to overcome as a result of it. And he meets Jesse and he makes allies and he meets enemies like Tuco and Gus. Tuco. That's like the whole thing of the whole series is basically him adapting to this and overcoming the struggles. And by, you know, near the end of the series, he has gotten what he's wanted. He has so much money that he has to buy a storage facility and just fill it with cash. He's feared. He's at the top of his game. He's got power. He's right.
His cancer's cured by then as well, right?
Is it? I don't remember.
I can't remember. They like almost forget that he has cancer, I think, at one point. Anyway, yeah. Okay.
But he has achieved what he has wanted.
Which was security for his family.
Yeah, and just power and feeling important and feeling like he's accomplished something in his life. Mm-hmm. Then he gets to point six where he has to pay a price for it. And he pays multiple prices. His family is destroyed. These are spoilers, so, you know, skip 30 seconds ahead. Or maybe not. No, everyone knows an important character dies. And this parallels too, and that, you know, destroys him. He suffers huge emotional consequences and fallout in his life as a result of these things.
Yeah.
And then in the, you know, he runs away from all of it. He leaves, and he kind of goes back to a familiar situation when he comes back from hiding and he goes back to his house and it's all abandoned and destroyed.
Yeah. But he leaves the world of drug dealing, right?
He leaves the world of drug dealing, but he's kind of in danger still. And then eventually he comes back to the familiar place, which is like his house in Albuquerque. And he goes to a diner and he has a 52 in bacon on his plate. Mm. And he walks around his abandoned house, which is like all burned down and destroyed. And then he demonstrates how he changed the result of it. Sure. And he rescues Jesse. And that's how the rest of the series ends. So I think that was it without giving away too many spoilers. But yeah.
No, that works. It's interesting that it works as well when... spoiler. What? It doesn't necessarily have a positive ending. It's good.
There's kind of no value or ethics attached to this. Like, you could do this circle with someone having a boring life and deciding they want to become a serial killer and going through their first kill and adapting to it. And
like Dexter.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Dexter's still kind of a good guy. I don't know. I've only seen
by
a couple
Hollywood
seasons.
Standards.
But
Hollywood thinks that flipping Tony Soprano and Walt are good guys, so, you know, whatever. So it can work for any character's story arc. It doesn't have to be the positive.
It doesn't have to be like they've changed positively or they've come out the other end being a better person.
They've just gone through some change and some action.
They've overcome things and they've lost things and now they're changed for it.
It's interesting.
You want to do Fury Road?
Oh my
I know
God.
You love Fury
I love
Road.
Fury Road so much. Yes, let's do Fury Road.
One of the reasons why I think Fury Road resonated so well was because it was pared down to like a very basic story.
Yeah.
And
it's literally a road trip.
It was
trip.
Just great.
It's one road trip. It's
literally
amazing.
A road trip.
Oh, so good. So are we following Furiosa?
Yes, Furiosa, I think, is the protagonist.
Yeah.
I'll run through it relatively quickly here, but...
Nice.
Furiosa is in a relative zone of comfort. She's at the Citadel. She's an Imperator. Morton Joe trusts her.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something wrong with it. Emotionally, I think it's her feeling like a bad person, wanting some kind of redemption and wanting to do something good.
Yeah.
Like externally, it's seeing the wives being tortured and kept as, you know, sex slaves and wanting to help them.
Yeah.
So she enters a new situation. She frees the wives. She steals the war rig and she heads for the green place. Yeah. And that's also kind of her thing that is is motivating her. That's her hope. That's, you know, when she's in point number two and she's thinking about what's wrong and how bad everything is and how, you know, what she's wishing for is to go back to that green place. And that desire and that the idea that she could take the wives there and that would somehow give her, you know, redemption and make her a better person. That's her kind of motivating factor that drives her to do these things.
Her answers and her future lie over in the Greenfields. Yeah.
Right. So she steals the war rig, enters this world of, you know, trying to escape. And it's the audience is also entering this world of like warfare on the road and, you know, fighting on the road and all the different tribes. This is point four. We learn about the different kinds of villains there are. And you meet the war boys and she meets Max and you get introduced to the other villains like Immortan Joe's brothers or whatever they are, the bullet farmer and the people eater, the mayor of Gastown. And so, yeah, we learn all about the world and we learn about what it takes to survive and the different factions. And we meet the wives formally in this part too, also. And Nux, that's when you meet Nux.
Love Nux.
So then five is getting what she needs. She, again, a literal meeting with the goddess. She meets the Volvolini, the women that she remembers from birth. And this is a tension break, point of rest. You know, they find the Volvolini and they think that they're in a place of safety again and everything is okay.
And she literally gets out of the rig and like is calm for the first time since she made that decision.
And they pass through the night that where like there's like the weird things on stilts walking, but it's very dreamlike and it's tension is broken. It's a calm, dreamlike moment. Sure. Then she meets the Volvolini, which is getting what she's wanted. But now we're at point six. She has to pay a price for it. And the price that she pays is learning there is no green place.
Yeah, it's all gone.
And that's when, you know, Furiosa is on her knees screaming in the sand because she's lost this thing that has been motivating her. She thought that they had some kind of safety to get to. And it turns out they don't.
It's a heartbreaking scene.
It is. Mm. It's good. That's the price that she must pay. And then this is, again, it also kind of parallels too, because sometimes there is a refusal of the call. Like she doesn't necessarily know what to do here. She has to take things in her own hands, but she doesn't really know what to do. That's where Max helps her out. Mm. And he tells her, you know, you could drive whatever, how many, you know, 60 days out that way, but like you're not going to find anything. Yeah. And like, why don't we go back? Like, it'll be a hard day, but at least there's some chance if we go back that we'll survive together. Mm. And we might be able to get some kind of redemption. So they literally turn around the war rig and their caravan and they go back to the familiar place where they came from.
Yep.
And the bad guys try to follow them back to the Citadel, chasing them, and they have to fight them off, and all of their allies that they've met, you know, in the other half help them.
Yeah.
And you know, they fight them off, and now they're familiar with how things work and they work together as a team, and they defeat them. They return to the Citadel, and now things have changed. Furiosa is going to be in charge. They open the gates and all the water pours out over the crowd, and you see, you know, how far things have come.
Yeah. God, it works so well.
It does work really well, doesn't it?
I love it. That film is amazing. That might be a flawless movie.
It's definitely amazing. I think it is near perfect, but
yeah, I love it. And I'm starting to like get my head around how as well. I mean, with Fury Road, it is really balanced. They almost spend exactly the same amount of time on each of those areas. But I can see, like, when we're talking about Breaking Bad, how like a majority of the action is in like four and five.
Yeah, I think most movies, the last couple points happen much quicker than the first part.
Yeah.
And usually four is the longest part. That's where you're adapting to the new world. It's friends, allies, enemy. A lot of times one and two happen very quickly. Established protagonists show that there's something wrong.
Yeah.
They enter the new world and then you spend a lot of time kind of learning and adapting in the new world up to the climax where the character gets what they need but pay a price for it. And then there's kind of like them, you know, surviving it and changing as a result of it. And then that's the ending.
Lush.
But yeah, and you know, when we were talking about rom-coms in the other episode,
oh yeah, it definitely works for rom-coms.
right? That cycle I described of like, oh, you meet a protagonist, but they have a problem. They're unlucky in love. Then there's a meet cute. They literally enter a new situation, a new romantic situation.
They start a new job or they meet a new person on their run or whatever. Right. Yeah. And new neighbor, whatever.
There's complicating situation with this new person, right? There's obstacles. Maybe they just see each other as friends. Yeah, there's something like that. They have to adapt to it. They finally get what they need, which is usually like realizing that they care about that person or the mission that they were on together to like, oh, let's help each other get back with our exes. They maybe get that, but it's not really what they wanted. Then they take things in their own hands now because they understand what love is, and they go back to the person and they tell them, you know, I realized the proper place of love in my life. I've changed. I'm now the master of both worlds. Mm. So the rom-com cycle matches up with this like really perfectly.
And I mean, it's probably why we talked about how rom-coms always feel quite formulaic. And it's probably because they're basically just doing this without the need to, you know, instill it with any real feeling.
But, I know. I think the best point of the rom-com episode was if you just do it like a checklist effect.
Yeah, it's never like impactful.
These things have to happen organically as a result of the character's journey. You can't just kind of force, you can't just go through the motions of this, because it might look like a story and resonate as a story to people, but they'll be like, I've seen this a million times.
Yeah. Well, it's what you said that Trey and Matt said about this happened, therefore, because, and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
We could do more. I don't know if it's necessary to keep doing more, but.
No, it's cool. I kind of like.
You can do Harry Potter. You want to do Harry Potter?
Okay, let me try. I'm like going to be really rubbish at this. So Harry is established and he's a poor orphan who's very mistreated by his family. And right.
But it's relatively stable.
It's stable. You know,
it's a known quantity of the world.
He understands the world, and he's under the stairs and starving to death. But it's fine. It's stable and known. Then he goes to the zoo and he magics away the glass. So he realizes.
Are you just doing the first book? Because you should do the whole series, I think.
Really? Oh, okay.
The whole series fits.
Okay.
You know, I mean, he's miserable. Like, what you're describing is also point two, that he's not happy in that world. He wishes he was special. He wishes that there was more to life than, like, living under the stairs and being treated horribly.
And then magic is introduced to his life because Hagrid turns up.
Hagrid and Dumbledore introduce him to the magic. World of witchcraft and wizardry.
And then he literally enters Hogwarts, which is literally the magical realm.
Mm-hmm. And most of the books, I think, constitute the trials where he's overcoming danger. He's learning the rules of the world. He's gaining skills.
Making friends.
Making friends, allies.
Lots of allies, making enemies. Mm-hmm. So then number five is he realizes the prophecy. He figures out the prophecy. He figures out that he has to kill Voldemort or Voldemort has to Voldemort will kill him. That happens in book five.
This is book. Yeah, I think you're a more Harry Potter expert. I feel like somewhere in book six is where things seem to be good. He gets what he needs. Like, he's going on the adventures with Dumbledore, finding the Horcruxes.
Sure. Yeah,
he starts dating Ginny. I think that's like a things seem good, you've made it kind of moment.
Okay. Like,
but I don't know. You know more specifically about what happens than I do.
No, I think you're right, because basically in five he figures out that he has to kill Voldemort or Voldemort will kill him, and then all of a sudden Dumbledore, who's been keeping him on the bench all this time, suddenly
and
is
keeping
like,
him at arm's length.
Yeah.
And now they're like buddies.
Suddenly he's like, you have to come on all these trips with me, and like Harry is kind of got agency and he's excited because he's finally getting to actually do something after years of sort of being put back.
And he gets Ginny. Meeting with the goddess. Yep. Cannot be underrated.
Yeah.
And I think things seem good. Obviously, we all know what he loses in six, the
he
price that is
in
paid.
He loses in six, pays that big price. Well, I've already said Dumbledore. Dying.
Yeah, Dumbledore dies. And it parallels the thing that has been motivating him and guiding him and drawing him through the story up until this point, which is Dumbledore.
But then,
he has to lose it.
And then in the seventh bit, it's when he leaves the world, right? But that works as well because he doesn't go back to Hogwarts.
Well, I think at that point, so maybe we're stretching a little bit, but Hogwarts becomes the familiar place where he must return to, having changed.
Oh, well, he does eventually for the battle. Yeah.
Right.
Well, he leaves for a little while anyway, but he goes
through... Well, they lose Hogwarts, right? They basically Hogwarts become...
It gets taken
Voldemort
over.
Voldemort takes over everything, the whole wizarding world.
Yeah.
And then they return for the battle.
And they have the Battle of Hogwarts and reclaim it. And, yep,
and everyone is back together, all their allies, all the people that you've met throughout the whole series.
Literally everyone in the book
is there. The centaurs, like everybody comes back.
Fucking everyone's there, yeah.
So that parallels four, where like you've learned all these things and made all these allies and overcome all these obstacles. Amazing. And now you're using all of that. And it shows how he's changed, like his relationship to death and to life.
Well, he's willing to do the ultimate sacrifice.
Right. Oh, he's literally master of both worlds. Yeah. He like dies, goes to the place after death and has a conversation like the, and it contrasts, you know, Voldemort, who is afraid of death. And Voldemort's desperately trying to be the master of both worlds. But he's trying to stay in the top of the circle. He's trying to like stay in life zone. And Harry Potter goes through the death zone.
He literally dies. Yeah.
So then he becomes a world altering ninja.
That's
and
him.
He defeats Voldemort, and then he gets to go back to a place of comfort and live happily ever after.
That's cool. I like it. So it works for all genres. It's interesting. Not all of these theories work for all genres.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is like the kind of the core thing that like I started out in the beginning, that I think certain structures resonate more with people, and I think the reason they resonate is they mirror the nature of the experiences we have.
Well, you're just anchored in it, aren't you?
That's what this does.
When the way people experience the world is how you would experience the world, it makes the world more believable to you.
It's recognizable as a journey, as something that the characters are going through.
Yeah. And when you see people going through the kinds of things that you go through, it's easy for you to be empathetic and invested in them. Because
right. Well, that works
we have
on
that
both
shared
levels.
Experience, you know?
The specific experiences, but also the idea that the way they are experiencing is similar to the way that
totally.
You experience the world.
Yeah, I mean, I've never done magic or been a wizard, but like I can still see that the way they experience that landscape is reflected in how I experience my own world and my equivalents. I'm still bitter about the fact that I'm not actually a wizard, obviously. I don't know if that's coming across.
There's all kinds of things that we go through, like starting a new job or going traveling, and that, you know, basically our lives mirror the structure in many, many ways.
Totally.
There's definitely more, I think, very sophisticated films kind of do this without being obvious that they're doing it.
Sure.
And, you know, you could do this even telling a story that's not linear. And, you know, maybe someone who challenges the idea would say, well, like, we don't experience life non-linearly, or like, you know, the cycles of society and of ecosystems and of our own personalities don't happen non-linearly. And I think that's true. And I think if you did just do something, like if you just took Die Hard and you reversed every scene in Die Hard and watched it backwards, that would not be as compelling as watching it straight through. But I think if you craft a story, and you have to be really skilled to do this, where the events are happening like non-linearly, I think that someone, even if it's just, you know, the audience or whatever, is going through this circle still and hitting all these points, even if maybe the specific events aren't happening in the order that they happen chronologically in the world of the movie, that they're still following kind of the story circle.
Sure.
So, yeah, I mean, it's a pretty powerful idea. I don't see it talked about that much, in writing classes and film analysis.
I'm surprised, actually, because it's really interesting and it's clearly quite applicable.
Yeah, and once you internalize this, like, I think about this all the time.
You just ruined all movies for me. Am I not going to be able to watch them without applying this theory now?
You do get better at predicting movies. Like, I've had people be annoyed at me, like, accuse me of seeing movies before and then rewatching them. And I've been annoyed that I've ruined things because I can't, like, you see this unfolding so many stories. And you also start to have a good barometer for when a story's gone off circle.
Sure.
And you find yourself being like bored or being like, what is happening here? I don't understand what, like, you know, I'm not into this movie anymore. And then you like think to yourself, like, where are we on the circle? You're like, I have no idea. I don't know what's going on here. Once you, I think, kind of internalize it and get used to seeing it, you just see it everywhere. You see it all of, I mean, you can see in individual scenes, you can see it in the whole arc of a TV show, you can see it in an episode, you can see it in scenes, you can, like, once you know, you know, I mean, this kind of makes you, like, you know, a crazy beautiful mind person, like, where you're just drawing circles and circles everywhere.
Go full Moya.
But it's a really powerful idea, and it works even if you're not creating stories. I mean, I think if you're creating stories, it's a great kind of way to shape an outline and, sure, and mold, you know, mold your own kind of creative ideas into something that is recognizable as a story. But even if you're just, you know, consuming them and being enjoying them, I think there's value in kind of seeing, consciously recognizing the cycle that a story goes through.
Love a deep analysis. It's great.
Yeah. So I don't know. I hope that this was, like, interesting to people. We haven't done, like, straight theory in a very long time.
I like it. It's been a while since we've done a straight theory. I don't think we've done theory since the three types of hero.
Yeah, like the ideal hero versus pragmatic hero.
Yeah. We talked about hero's journey a bit in that, but no, it's cool. I like it because I feel like it makes the whole viewing experience much fuller when you're able to enjoy it on a very kind of, like, I don't want to say superficial, but on a very superficial level, you can just enjoy a movie. But then, you know, when you do a deep dive and a deep analysis like this, it's so much more satisfying. And it's always nice to feel like you know stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I like knowing why things work. Like, why is Fury Road so good of a movie?
Oh, such, like, a great movie.
And obviously there's tons of other elements, like the acting and the directing and the dialogue and all that stuff, the score. But this structure is, like, the thing that has to be there. I think even if you have good acting, even if you have other stuff, if this structure isn't there, you lose a really compelling element of the story.
And if the structure isn't executed properly, like, what
you can tell it's a story feels sloppy, yeah, and all over the place.
Like, if it's just points of activity, you're just like, yeah, but how did this even happen and how did we get here? That's really unsatisfying. And it's a lot of what are the problems with the films that we always pick on, but, like, the Transformers movies are a good example.
Try story circling the Transformers movies. Who is even the protagonist?
Who is the protagonist, like, in that? Is it Optimus Prime? I have no idea. Anyway, it's I think this is going to be a really helpful barometer for whether or not a film's good or not. But no, it's great. I enjoyed it. Thank you for taking the time to explain it to me.
Yeah. Well, thanks for listening to, you know, me be in a Will analysis mode.
You're in Moya mode. Hour. That's okay. I liked it.
All right. So, you know, if you have any kind of, like, feedback about this, or you think I'm wrong or I'm missing something, let me know.
Get in touch.
There's a lot of, I'm going to put a ton of links in the show notes to Dan Harmon's articles about this and Wikipedia entries about, like, Joseph Campbell's The Hero's Journey and stuff like that. And if you story circle any movies, if there's, like, a book or a TV show or something that you really like, and all of a sudden listening to the points of the story circle, you're like, oh my God, it fits so well. Let me know, because I like hearing it. I like knowing it. You hear examples and you don't realize how well they fit this until someone lays it out for you.
I would love to request someone to do a horror one for me. Maybe our friends that, Bimbo Movie Bash could do it for us, but I would love a horror one, because I'm not familiar with the genre. I'm still interested in how this would work in the horror genre, because it is quite specific. So if anyone fancies doing the story circle for a horror movie, I would love you forever.
Okay, so thanks for listening, guys.
Thank you.
And thank you to Joshua Desain for the music you're hearing,
as always.
See you next time.
Bye.